Butang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, welcome to our guests tonight, and this is one of our twice weekly meetings of the community. If at any point you can't hear me, just wave because my voice tends to drop. Can you hear me okay at the back? Yeah, great. So Wednesday night, usually we've got a swelling of monastic community here at the moment. Usually there's three nuns resident, but we have the pleasure of welcoming four visiting monastics for a while. And of course our lay guests, and a few more people are gathering this week because a special guest, Bhante Sujato, is doing a meditation afternoon on Saturday here, meditation and Dhamma reflections, if you're interested. So this is a traditional time where our community meets at least once or twice a week. It's a traditional habit of a Buddhist monastic community set up by the Buddha, encouraged people who were living together and practicing together to come together and to reflect on Dhamma, to support each other in the practice. And it's a different quality to practicing on one's own, meditating in one's own kuti in the woods, in the forest, or reading on one's own, doing one's own study. To be able to hear the Dhamma is something altogether different, and also for those who have taught the Dhamma, being able to teach the Dhamma is something different as well. And both of these occasions, the Buddha actually said through hearing the Dhamma, profound insight can arise. And even for those who are teaching the Dhamma, it's a good thing to teach. It's a different way of tuning into the Dhamma, and it can also be very beneficial. So for monastics to learn how to sit and reflect openly, not so much in our tradition, we don't prepare talks, but learn to sit in the present moment and offer reflection for people to reflect on their own practice, on their own understanding of the Dhamma in a meditative way. Ajahn Chah, I heard, would say, when you're listening to Dhamma, listen with the heart, not the ears. This is an important distinction because in a meditative sense, you're tuning in with the whole of your being. In a way, when what he was pointing to, if we listen with our ears, well, kind of the ears are very close to our brains, of course, and we start analysing and thinking and nitpicking and comparing this and comparing that, and we just end up thinking about it. But if we listen with the heart, we may not remember every word, but it's a whole new or different dimension of listening. And in a way, this is also how we should learn to practice, learn to, whether alone or with others, in meditation. What would it be to meditate with our whole being? I think for Westerners, we often get caught in meditating through our heads, thinking about it, or thinking about what I should be doing in meditation, or thinking about how I should be doing it, or thinking about what it should be like, not what it is like. You know, we often set up a goal in our mind, even as simple as, oh, meditation is about getting peaceful. And we sit down and we expect that, you know, peace to arise. I should do something to make my mind peaceful. And then if you're sitting and practicing and you don't become peaceful, you can get a bit agitated or upset and think, oh, I'm not doing it right. I have to try harder, or not stop trying so hard, or do this or do that, you know. And all of this is part of a path of learning in meditation. But, you know, learning what works, what doesn't work, how to apply attention and how to apply energy in the right way. However, just this question maybe to bring to mind, what is it just to sit with our whole being? As Ajahn Chah said, to listen with the heart. What is it to sit with the heart and listen with our whole being just to this moment, just to this experience of sitting with whatever is happening in this body, in this mind, in this moment, without the overlays of expectation or desire or fear or hope or aversion, even though those things may be arising and passing through the mind, can we still sit with our whole being and have a heart big enough to let that stuff move through, to not grab onto things and not reject things, to not pick and choose, to not say this is good, that's bad? Can we open our heart to our whole experience of being, just for what it is, without expectation, without hope, without fear? This is a completely different quality of experience if we can do that. It's so important to be able to keep opening the mind and opening the heart to our experience, because even though part of our learning, a big part of our learning, is developing skill in practice and reading the teachings of the Buddha, all of these teachings and ultimately all the skills we learn are actually bringing us back to this place, here, now, with just what is. Just what this experience of body-mind is. Which may be a bit of a rude shock for some people, because they're hoping to get away from what is. This is often how we begin the path. We very much can feel dissatisfied with our life, or with the world the way it is, or with whatever we're experiencing, and we seek something that will help, something that will make sense to us. So this is not a wrong thing, this is not a bad thing at all. But as we come to the path of Buddhist meditation, it kind of turns us back around on ourselves, because the Buddha is saying there is this profound reality to realize that almost all beings are bound by the experience of greed, hatred and delusion, these three deep and powerful forces in the mind, and they constantly bring suffering in our lives. And the Buddha's teaching is pointing to the fact that there is an escape from that. There is the possibility to thoroughly wake up to snap out of ignorance of this this predicament we find ourselves in. It's possible to completely relinquish or move beyond these forces of greed, hatred and delusion. But it's not through running away from them. It's not through ignoring them or suppressing them or even through analyzing them, understanding them through the intellect. But actually we have to meet these things within our own experience. But meet them with skillfulness, meet them with the developing power of wisdom. But this wisdom is developed, this wisdom is built from actually engaging these experiences. So the Buddha's teaching builds, the whole beginning of his teaching in one of his first teachings to the five companions, where he introduces to them this a way that he articulated his own experience of awakening. He articulated it in terms of having understood four very powerful transformative truths. And he talked about them as Arya Satcha, that gets translated as noble truths. Don't particularly like the word noble, it doesn't really convey the power of these truths, but these truths brought Gotama to full awakening. He'd said he hadn't, these things he hadn't heard before, he hadn't seen before in his own experience, but it was through the full understanding of them that he came to full awakening, that he fully understood these forces of greed, hatred and delusion, and was able to abandon identification with them. Abandon abandon the clinging, which allowed an escape. But he said he would, if he hadn't, it wasn't until he'd fully understood these four truths that the full liberation came about. And these truths are pointing us, constantly pointing us back to that which we find ourselves usually running away from, the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering. The first truth, the truth of suffering, also pointing to the truth of the cause of suffering. There is a cause, and it can come to cessation. Cessation of dukkha being the third truth. And the path or the way to bring that about or to develop skillfulness in order that that comes about is the fourth truth that he understood. And these truths are all connected, intrinsically connected. I've said before with the community, the Buddha actually said that if one has insight, deep penetrating insight into any one of these truths, one automatically understands the other three. So the thing about these truths, he points, is these truths are experiences in our own body-mind. They're not truths out there to be discovered, you know, through the telescope or the microscope or the universities or in the tombs of ancient religious teachings, the tomes or tombs. They're actually present here in this body-mind. Each person for themselves can recognize these truths within their own body-mind experience. He said, in this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception, is dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness or stress or suffering, its arising, its cessation, and the path to its cessation. It's quite a profound thing to say. In the same teaching, he said, in this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception, is the world, the arising of the world, the cessation of the world, the path leading to the cessation of the world. Again, very profound teaching. He went on to clarify the world in his teaching is the experience through the senses, through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body and mind. This is where we experience the world. This is how we experience the world. Through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. So everything can be known here. Through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. The mind that we seek to understand, we use this mind to understand itself. When we perceive through the senses, this is how we experience the world, through the senses. And this can be known directly. This was the key. The Buddha often would say that he teaches the Dhamma, the truth, by means that you can see for yourself directly, because this is truly the only way to awaken. We must see these truths, have insight to this reality directly. So if you can't apprehend that reality in your own experience, then there's no possibility for awakening. So his teaching is structured and geared for you to recognize certain truths in your own experience of body-mind and to examine, to investigate, to penetrate. So this is why we meditate. This is what meditation is about. Because we're usually so, human beings are usually so busy and caught up in chasing our desires and running from our fears and the things we're averse to, that we actually become quite busy internally and externally. And, you know, just within that you could read the history of the world, the running towards the things we want and the running away or the killing off of the things we don't want. And this creates the chaos in the world, within and without, outside and inside. So meditation, the path of meditation, is giving ourselves the opportunity to let that activity still for a while. And it's a path of learning this some meditative skill. It doesn't mean you become proficient in just being peaceful all the time, but it can you can develop enough stillness of body and mind to begin to see clearly just what's happening through these sense doors when we see, hear, smell, taste, touch and think and know things through the mind. And when we experience emotional reaction, experience desire and aversion, to know them as they are. Because unless we can develop just enough stillness to recognize these experiences as they are and as they come and go, we won't see the truth the Buddha's pointing to. So enough stillness to begin to recognize some particular characteristics the Buddha pointed to as key. And you'll find throughout all the Buddhist teachings these four truths and three characteristics of existence, the kind of meat and potatoes of Buddha Dhamma, really, But it's at the heart of realization to come back to recognize this truth of anicca, one of the three characteristics of existence. Anicca being the quality or the characteristic of impermanence, of change, of transience, of the instability of all conditioned things, how things change. Now, when we think about it, we might think, well, this is a very mundane kind of truth. It's so obvious. We're so clear about this in science, and we overlook it. You know, we intellectually know that everything changes. We actually intellectually know that whatever is born dies. We scientifically understand this in a very detailed way. But if we'd really understood this, we'd be at least Sotapanna. We'd be at least someone who'd realized the first stage of awakening. Someone who is bound for full awakening, inevitably. If we really understood this truth of anicca. That was the insight of Kundanya in the first teaching that the Buddha gave on the Four Noble Truths to these five companions. One of them, at the end of his discourse, realized the first stage of awakening. And you know what his insight was? All that arises ceases. But this is an insight. He was looking at his own mind. He was looking at the myriad things that were arising and ceasing, the thoughts, the feelings, perceptions, mental constructions, mental activity, the activity of the senses. But he'd stilled his mind enough to see and recognize deeply that all of these things are coming and going, they're rising and ceasing, and his mind was still enough to recognize the cessation of those things. And in the cessation, he saw something more. Or he saw what remained when this activity ceased for a moment. This is the glimpse, the first glimpse of the deathless, which heralds in that first awakening. The deathless, that which does not change, that which does not arise or cease. Penetrated, understood in his personal experience with this body-mind. See, this is the third noble truth. The cessation of suffering can be realized and should be realized here and now in our own experience, with the very mundane things that we're experiencing all the time. Feelings, perceptions, emotions, thoughts, sense activity, the stuff of our life, the cycling of our life. So if we learn to establish this right view in meditation, it's not about getting rid of the painful things. It's not about getting rid of the unwanted things. It's not just about being peaceful or getting peace at all costs or getting special powers. Ultimately, the awakening, liberating experience is seeing that all this stuff changes. It arises and ceases, and it's not who and what we are. It's the habit of ignorance and identification that creates identity out of this experience. And this is such a deep, deep habit. But the more we can observe the changingness of our experience, the arising and ceasing of a thought, a feeling, a perception, a mental construct, an idea, a sense impression, the more we become familiar with that reality as we meet it, as we experience it. Not as we think about it, but as we experience it, it shows you its own nature. So the observing mind, that which can know, that which can see, this is where wisdom develops. This is where we're using the mind with its own natural qualities of knowing, of awareness, to look clearly. It's a bit like, you know, that, you know, if you put a magnifying glass over something, over a piece of paper or some grass, and you channel the rays of the sun, it becomes intensified and ignites a fire if all the conditions are correct. So our meditative experience or cultivating at least some degree of stillness acts a bit like that when you turn the knowing mind, that which knows, that which can see, when the mind is still, to an experience. When the mind has some stability, to an observe and experience, we can see it in a clearer way. It has more intensity. That light of awareness, if you like, can see more clearly, can ignite some insight, some deep penetrative understanding, just into this simple nature of something as simple as a perception arising and ceasing. But what makes it more powerful, when that observing mind, that knowing mind is strong, is strengthened with wisdom and mindfulness and stability, if it's strengthened with equanimity, one's observing is crisp. And with the cessation of a particular experience, one can truly penetrate into that truth of anatta, the not-self nature of things. When something ceases and disappears in your own experience as you're observing it, it's no longer there. How can we say, this is me, mine, what I am? It's very clear. It's disappeared, ceased. When the knowing mind, when the wisdom mind sees that clearly, it can cut through. Usually we have a murky mind and we continue this sense of identity. Well, I was maybe angry this morning, I feel better now, but you know, it's my anger, I'll probably feel it again another time. We assume a continuity, we assume an ownership, we assume an identity. I'm like this, these are all my faults, these are my problems, this is where I'm going, this is what I have to do to get rid of it. We assume so much. And these are all mental processes in and of themselves. But with meditation, the more we develop this capacity to rest into here and now and keep unhooking from that kind of continual assumption of me and mine, every thought that moves through the mind, me and mine, every feeling that arises, me and mine, every memory, perception, me and mine. There's this assumption, this automatic assumption. Now, if we haven't seen this before, you probably think, what am I talking about? What's she talking about? Of course it's me and mine. Whose else is it? But the more you meditate, the more you create space with mindfulness, you actually begin to see this pattern of arising, ceasing. The gaps between the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, sense contact. Who are you then in the gaps? Have you noticed the gaps? We haven't been trained to notice the gaps. No one's pointing to the ending of things in our world, except for the Buddha. No one's pointing to say, hey, have a look. It's not actually a continuity, an endless continuity. Samsara feels endless until you can experience or see these gaps and moments of cessation. Now, it's a funny word. We get accustomed to using this word sensation. It's a translation of the word nirodha. And there's many ways you can translate it, and in a way cessation doesn't come across so well in our language, I don't think. But forgive me, because we get used to using that in Buddhist circles. Nirodha has other ways of talking about it, like release or unbinding, or something that is no longer confined or in confinement. So maybe we can look at that in terms of the heart released, or the mind released from confinement, yeah, of identity in relation to a set of feelings or perceptions or thoughts. You know, if you're not who you think you are, does that feel like a relief? To me, most of the time. You know, we assume we are who we think we are. But if we examine these thoughts, they're moving through like fierce winds pushing clouds through the sky. Where do the clouds come from? Where do they go? Are they substantial? Are they permanent? This is a radical pointing, you know, to look at these experiences of body mind, and to challenge one's assumed identity, assumed perceptions. And in fact, it takes a stable mind to do that, and through meditation and the cultivation of the path, what we call sila, samadhi, panya, that's, you know, cultivating wholesomeness and skillfulness in body, speech and mind. This helps create stability so we can investigate the mind, investigate the assumptions, and start dissolving the delusion. Well, delusion begins to dissolve by itself just through clear seeing, just through developing this stillness and inquiry with the right view. So if all one remembers in one's practice are these four truths, being present in one's own body, mind, to be realized, to be seen clearly, and these three characteristics of all the experience you can observe, internally or externally, these three characteristics apply. They're three characteristics that the Buddha said, they're there, they're like stamps on all conditioned reality to be seen, whether a Buddha arises in the world or not, whether Dharma is taught in the world or not, anyone looking will be able to see these things. So these aren't created truths, they're just part of reality. But he said, if you observe these three things in reality, your mind will begin to clear. Delusion will dissolve because you're seeing clearly. Because our perversion of perception, our distorted perception, that tends to see the impermanent things as permanent. Or maybe it's just our wishful thinking a lot of the time. It's our delusion and wishful thinking. We want things to be permanent, but they keep dissolving, you know? And denial is hiding from that truth. We hide from that truth. So it's actually quite a relief to own up to it. Say, actually, yeah, this body is dissolving. Having been born, it's getting old, it'll die. Everywhere you look in nature, everywhere you look internally in this body mind, it's the same story. So who are we? Who are you? What are we hanging on to? What are we chasing here? Yeah? Profound challenge. But if you just look at that, it clears, starts to clear the mind's delusion all by itself. Just just to determine to see that around in the trees, the leaves falling, a day beginning and ending, a meal beginning and ending, a life beginning, maintaining for a while and ending. The life of the sun also has an end. This world has an inevitable end. Everywhere we look, internal or external, it's there. But it's changing right now. It's not as if we have to wait to see something die. And we don't need the microscope either. We just need to look at our own perception, which is arising and ceasing, our own sense consciousness. A sound comes and goes. A visual contact is just a moment, maybe a few sustained moments, but then it changes. Smells waft in and out. Tactile sensations are momentary, a cascade of change. Thoughts are momentary, memories arising in the present, they arise and cease. The emotions that they, reactive emotions, memories may give rise to, they arise and cease. Usually we don't see it because we just get born into it, we find identity in it, and then we struggle to try and hang on to the pleasant, get rid of the unpleasant. But if we see that, if the mind learns to see that as well, we can release ourselves from that, release the mind from identifying with that. So this path of practice is one of releasing the heart from the confines of identity with small things, with limited things, with impermanent things, changing things. Things that the Buddha said aren't who and what you are. For him it was so obvious, having a fully awakened mind. One of the things he was teaching a group of monks one day was, he said, "Do you see these grasses and sticks in the park around you? And if you saw people coming in and picking up the grass and the sticks and taking it away, would you say, 'Oh, they're taking me away? They're taking what's mine away'?" They'd say no. He said, "Well, that's just what's going on in your mind. You're picking up what these experiences of body-mind, these momentary experiences, physical and mental experiences, of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, mental constructs, ideas, you're picking them up and you're saying they're me and mine." He says, "I see very clearly they're not." And it's his vision of seeing that which has released his heart completely. And that's, that release heralds in the cessation of all suffering. That act of identifying, that act of clinging with things that are conditioned and changing, temporary, unstable. That act of clinging and identifying with them is what is the root cause of our suffering. But this needs to be seen. The Buddha points to the truth because he's fully awoken. He has the perspective of being able to look back and see, from the top of the mountain, see the path which he came up. He can see where people are at, what obstructions. He devised this teaching to help them follow the same path he took to realize, direct realization. So it's important to understand this point of direct realization. We read the teachings in order to orient, to become familiar with the pointings to something. We contemplate what that means in terms of our own experience, so we can guess in a way it's developing the mind maps to help us cultivate this path. But the realization is not intellectual. Insight is not conceptual. So we call this direct knowing. You see it clearly in your own experience. It's thoroughly verifiable in your own experience. And that kind of insight just cuts through all doubt. But the beauty of this teaching, I always find, is that it's just working with what's present. You are not lacking in anything at any given time. Even though we may think we are, we're actually not. If we can just establish the right perspective, which is established through remembering these four truths are present within us. And recognizing, we can always recognize the truth of dukkha, the truth of stress or unsatisfactoriness. Even if it's just a very subtle, aversion or a subtle restlessness or grumpiness or whatever it is, we can either be grumpy, like thoroughly identify with that, which is dukkha, which is suffering, or we can turn the mind and say, this is the experience of grumpiness. This is the first noble truth. It feels like this. It's a 180 degree turnaround. So the experience in and of itself is not necessarily the issue. It's about developing that wisdom of perspective, that right view, turning everything into Dhamma. You find your liberation is possible here and now, where it's always possible. It's never possible in the future. It's only possible here and now. With whatever one's experiencing. Because it's all Dhamma. It all falls within the scope of this body-mind. This world arising and ceasing. In this very body-mind. So allowing oneself to experience the cessation of something. In a way, the mind will skip over it unless you introduce yourself to what this means. To notice the beginning and the ending of things in small ways. Just to notice, to bring your mindfulness, your awareness to bear on that. That's all. And the more you notice the ending of things, you begin to notice the gaps before a new arising, but also the peace as things fade. And as a sense of entrapment in some kind of identity fades. The release the Buddha's pointing to is something that can be realized and must be realized in your own experience. There was a little part of a sutta I read earlier today. It kind of fits in, so I might just leave you with this teaching. It's the called the Shorter Discourse on the Destruction of Craving, or the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta. And there's a very, very succinct teaching in here. There's Buddha's teaching someone called Sakka, the ruler of the gods. And he asks the Buddha, he says, how in brief is someone liberated in the destruction of craving? One who's reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, one who's foremost among gods and humans. How, in brief, are they liberated this way? And the Buddha says, here, Sakka, a bhikkhu or practitioner has heard that nothing is worth adhering to. Nothing is worth clinging to. When they hear that nothing is worth clinging to, they directly know everything. Having directly known everything, they fully understand everything. Having fully understood everything, whatever feeling they feel, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, they abide contemplating impermanence in those feelings, contemplating fading away, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. In contemplating thus, they do not cling to anything in the world. When they do not cling, they're not agitated. And when they're not agitated, they personally attain Nibbana. Briefly, it is in this way that someone is liberated in the destruction of craving, is one who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, one who is foremost among gods and humans. So for me, I mean, I've known this teaching for years, but just that one liner. When someone has heard that nothing is worth adhering to, they directly know everything. So just contemplate that for a moment. What it does for me is open my mind. It's suggesting nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. When I contemplate that, my mind and heart opens to seeing that. If I hear it deeply with the heart, my mind's poised to truly consider that truth. Nothing is worth clinging to. And the Buddha says, when you really get that, you've directly known everything. Because this is such a succinct truth. If nothing is worth clinging to, and one clings to nothing, you directly know everything in that sense. Here's another way of putting it, by Dogen Zenji. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. So I'll leave you with those words from the masters tonight. Andamayandam.
Namaste. Sadhu.